I always feel when we start these things on a day like today that we've already achieved our greatest accomplishment, which is we made it to Friday. So there we go. And here we are, and we're very, very excited. We had a fun drive for much of the week, and today's show. We're so glad to be back. Thank you again for everything that you've done. And so we have a lot going on. Just a couple quick programming notes here. One is we're going to have a slightly shorter than usual panel discussion. One is because we have some stuff we need to get in because we were not on the air earlier in the week, so we're going to do that in our 10 o'clock hour. And we also want to make room for a really cool Pride Month special that we came across called Real Music, R-E-E-L, Real Music Pride Pictures. Real Music takes listeners to the movies where we can enjoy music from films with LGBTQ plus themes. And that special will be coming up at 11 o'clock this morning. So we'll have a lot going on over this over the next 3 hours. And we thank you very much for being with us. Let me introduce our panel to you. Judith Enck is here, a senior fellow and faculty member in the Center for the Advancement of Public Action at Bennington College. She is the president of Beyond Plastics and most important at this moment, she's co-author of the book, The Problem with Plastic. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be with you all.
Wonderful to have you with us. Allison Cavey is here, full professor in the history department at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Good morning, Allison.
Great to be here. And I always think the fund drive is such a great realization of the word faith. You have faith that you're going to raise that money. You did an amazing job. And I'm a junkie. I listen all the time. And it was just incredible to get it done again.
Well, thank you. Thank you very, very much. It feels good. It feels good. Makes Friday even more exciting now. Good stuff. Hey, Robert Pondicio is here, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Always love when Robert is here. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I am well and just pleased to be in a space that has air conditioning.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems to be a popular spot. They're doing renovation to the building, and not only that, but outside, the entire city of Albany is under construction, and but mostly right in front of the building. And so I think our biggest fear in this building is that like somebody is going to hit something, and we're going to lose power and or air conditioning or both.
Well, Joe, actually, crossing the street to get here this morning, remember that old game Atari where you
like Pitfall. Exactly. Yeah, you had to take the rope and go right across Central Avenue. Absolutely,
it was worth your life. It was an obstacle course. That's right.
No, when it's done, it'll be beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
Promises.
Yes, indeed. All right, let's get to the stories of the day and find out what's happening in this world of ours as of 9:16 on this Friday morning. So, the president has said that he has canceled plans to strike Iran and has claimed that a deal is near. This is after making threats that he was going to bomb them again. And now Trump withdrew his threats to take Iran's most critical oil terminal in the not-too-distant future after fresh attacks on the U.S. bases in the region. President Trump said that he had canceled the scheduled attacks on Iran after progress on a potential peace deal, his latest reversal in a months-long pattern of threatening attacks and walking them back. Speaking in the Oval Office, Trump asserted that an agreement to end hostilities would be, quote, maybe this weekend, end quote, after which the United States would immediately lift its naval blockade of the country. The deal would bar Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons, Trump said, an objective he has named a key in deciding to strike the country. Trump asserted that Iran's leaders had signed off on the agreement, but Iranian foreign ministry spokespeople said it would not move from its red lines. Iran has not yet reached a final conclusion on the agreement. they said in comments reported by state media. Pressed by reporters on whether an agreement was truly close after weeks of false starts, Trump said Iran's current leaders were, quote, much more rational than their predecessors and were worn out by the U.S. military attacks. We knocked out the first team of leadership, Trump said. The second team of leadership, this is a different group. It's a different level. And I think it's, frankly, a smarter level. The White House declined to offer details about the potential agreement. The president has asserted for weeks that a deal is close, even as he has issued new threats to attack Iran. Oh, Robert.
Why me, Joe? Well, look, to be earnest about this, I'm actually pleased for once that I have, on previous roundtables, staked out the position of not being reflexively opposed to this president and this military action, because frankly, I'm kind of at my frustration point with this now. I mean, I've lost track of the number of times that this president has said a deal is close.
Eight times.
Is it only eight? Yeah. I'm not joking. Really, only eight?
No, I would have thought it would have been more, too.
No, eight times that he said that Iran has agreed
right.
and that it's done.
Wow, it felt like so many more to me. But, I mean, you know, again, I'm not among those who think that, you know, any pressure on Iran is inherently bad policy. It remains a destabilizing force in the region. Preventing it from becoming a nuclear power is a legitimate American interest, in my opinion. But having said that, even those of us who are not reflexively opposed to this action and this president are entitled to wonder now whether the administration's constantly shifting signals are helping or hurting that objective. I tend to think we're now to the point where it's hurting.
Judith.
Well, I go back to 400 years ago when this war started, that Trump started. It feels like that. And I'm etched in my brain is this news availability that Trump did on a different topic. It was like 2 weeks into the war, and he cut it short, and he said, I need to cut this short because I have to go watch my war. And I was like, it's like a video game for him. And then I think I said on the show, he's going to get bored with his war. And now he's bored and Republicans are freaking out because of the price of gas. But my goodness, all of this death and destruction and waste of billions of tax dollars. Imagine if we used those billions for things like healthcare and education and Social Security, as opposed to a multi-billion dollar pointless war. I think he has buyer's remorse. You haven't seen Hegseth doing these 8 a.m. news conferences where he sounds like he's had like way too many Red Bulls. And the relationship with Israel is now strained. I think Trump did not get regime change. What he did was put in place a younger, more anti-democratic supreme leader in Iran. This so-called agreement, which I think is just a draft memorandum of understanding that Axios got their hands on, does not address the nuclear issue at all. They just kind of kick it down the road. And basically, it sounds like we're giving Iran a massive amount of our tax dollars to try to hold a ceasefire for 6 months. But I want this war to end. I hope it's over. I want to believe that maybe the eighth time is the charm. But the damage that has been done for no reason. I think Iran emerges now as a much stronger nation. They are a player on the national stage. They beat the United States and Israel. And I think, you know, look, with all of the problems there, they now hold more cards than they did before the war started.
I'm not so sure I agree with that. We don't really know what's going on inside of the Republic of Iran. Clearly, the strikes this week, and again, Joe, whenever we have this conversation, I'm always aware that I'm sounding very, very hawkish, and it's not my normal attitude towards these things. But we are able to strike this country with impunity. at any time we like. So I don't understand. Okay, let me take this back. I understand the political imperative for making a deal. It's the gas prices. It's the midterms. So, yes, Trump wants out. But if the price of getting out is you don't achieve the objectives that you started, you know, get a non-nuclear Iran, no ballistic missiles, no support for proxies that are threatening stability in the region, then I will agree with you that it was worthless. I don't think that it's a worthless endeavor going in, but if we end it without achieving those objectives, then yes, it will have been worthless.
Allison.
I think there's some confusion about whether Iran actually agrees with any of the things that we are currently calling a peace agreement. So the IRNA says they are looking at a draft agreement. There is nothing in that draft agreement about the Strait of Hormuz, and there is nothing about the nuclear agreement. So I don't think that this thing that might end, theoretically, this conflict is going to get us any further than we were before. And in fact, it takes us back before the Obama agreement. And so if this is the agreement that is going to be signed, and I highly doubt that, then in my opinion, this was a total waste of money and lives and extreme destruction for nothing.
Yeah, I tend to take with a grain of salt even news reports about what an agreement might be comprised of at this point. I just don't think we know, and I don't think we reliably can find out.
That's absolutely true. I think finding out is very difficult. One of the things that strikes me, and we talked about this, I believe, yesterday. Yeah, it had to be yesterday. That was our only show. Okay. That we look at the president has said that it's just waiting Iran's signature, and they haven't signed off on it yet. But what it seems like is that they have come up with a framework and a wish list, that the U.S. has come up with a wish list of what they want and said, here you go. And, I mean, the chances of that happening, because nothing seems to have moved mm-hmm. In any way. So then for that to be offered up as, at least in the president's mind, a clear signal that the war is near completion, because they have put in writing what they want to accomplish, mm-hmm. doesn't mean that they're going to agree to it.
You know, there's a card that the administration could play if it were more willing to be candid with the American public, and that is simply patience. By all reasonable accounts, the Iranian economy is in shambles right now. You know, their oil revenue has dried up. If we were able to maintain our posture of I mean, the ceasefire is nonsense, let's be honest. I mean, it's a kind of a non-ceasefire. But again, we can operate militarily with impunity. If we waited out this regime, I think that all of the objectives would be accomplished. It's just the political price of that domestically, maybe more than this, obviously, is more than this administration wants to pay.
I don't think it's a matter of patience. I think it's a matter of sheer incompetence by this administration, not having clear goals going in, not valuing the loss of human life, not just U.S. soldiers, but school kids that were killed, innocent civilians that were killed. And they think they have a blank check, because they kind of do. And they didn't go to Congress for approval. So that's why they keep going back and forth on whether this is a war or not a war. But I mean, I think this was just such a giant miscalculation. And there's a reason you go to Congress. So things are aired and debated and you get input. But these were two real estate guys who have no business negotiating an international agreement, and Pete Hegseth on their shoulder talking about his war fighters and his macho language. I mean, this is like from day one, we kind of knew this was going to be a disaster, and it just keeps getting worse.
The other thing too is the 8 times that you mentioned. I mean, the connection with that and the stock market and what we see. 2 days ago, the market was down significantly. The price of oil was up, and now U.S. stock futures, which market opens in just a few moments, stock futures rising on signs of a potential U.S.-Iran peace deal. So they're buying it in the sense of the ninth time's the charm. and then separately, there's also the SpaceX IPO, which is going to add into this as well. But I don't think we can take, like, we can't dismiss what the forces on the market here are.
I'm assuming, and, you know, reading the tea leaves with this administration is kind of a fool's errand. But my sense is that they are speaking as much to the market as to the Iranians. I mean, because let's be honest, we literally don't know who's on the other end of the phone in Iran. It's interesting to me, the comment that you read from Trump about how this third administration is more reasonable. Someone made the observation yesterday, I don't know who to credit it to, about how this is kind of Trump's negotiating style. He thinks that, you know, flattering our adversaries is a way to bring them to the table. It just doesn't work that way. It works with him, right? Like,
right.
If you flatter
Trump,
you get
that momentary high.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. But it doesn't seem to work in the opposite direction yet. He keeps playing that card.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation, move on to some other topics. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Judith Eng, Allison Cavey, and Robert Pendicio make up the group this morning. Again, we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Judith Eng, Allison Cavey, and Robert Pendicio. A couple letters. Ricky says, I would like a panelist to explain how the United States is going to get rid of Iran's massive stockpile of their destructive ballistic missiles, stop them from supporting their Hezbollah and Houthi allies, and how to ensure that Iran never gets a nuclear weapon. Please explain how that's going to be accomplished.
They're not.
None of that will be happening.
Well, not under this current regime. No, of course not. That's the point.
Not under any regime in Iran.
Oliver says, if a ceasefire with Iran included a clause for, quote, no support for proxies that are causing instability in the region, as was mentioned on the panel this morning, I could get behind that. Israel has been delivering far too many genocidal deaths with U.S.-supplied weapons of war. Then we go to this. When Robert Pendicio is the only person to defend the administration and present the other side so that WAMC can offer a balanced roundtable, America is truly screwed.
That seems kind of harsh. I thought he gave an eloquent defense.
I can't determine whether that is a supportive comment or a criticism.
You know what? I couldn't figure it out either. That's why I read it. I thought, okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. Exactly. Let's move on to...
the end of the letter is true.
The other comment.
I support the final clause.
The other topic this morning, we're going to talk about the new intelligence chief that has been picked. And I don't know. This story is the story, but just the fact that someone has that title of intelligence chief is just whatever point, whoever gets it is, you know, there's just room to giggle, I think.
It's a heck of a title.
Yeah, it sure is. So President Trump said on Thursday that he would nominate Jay Clayton, the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, to be the next director of national intelligence after the president faced a revolt from lawmakers over his choice for an interim director without any relevant experience. Mr. Trump had been under pressure to move on from his decision to appoint Bill Pulte, a top housing official, as the acting director, replacing Tulsi Gabbard, who announced last month that she would step down from the post. Mr. Pulte, who has used his current job to attack Mr. Trump's enemies, had come under withering criticism from Capitol Hill. Both Republicans and Democrats have argued that he was unqualified to lead the nation's intelligence agencies. Mr. Trump, in a social media post, encouraged the Senate to confirm Mr. Clayton as soon as possible. Allison.
I think there's been a very positive response to this nomination, specifically because in the interviews they all say, well, he's not Pulte, right? They're all very pleased about that. But there tends to be a codicil, which is, I'm willing to hear his qualifications, but at this point, he does not seem to have the depth of national intelligence experience that is defined in the post as a requirement for the post.
Right.
So,
but to ultimately replace Tulsi Gabbard, just for that, whatever. Okay, go ahead.
I mean, it's a relatively recent post, right? The DNI was created in 1995. This is an evolving position, I think, and it's one that has increased in power over time. And also its power seems to depend almost entirely on the administration. How much power are they willing to give it, and how much airtime or space are they willing to give it in negotiations? So I am not convinced that this is the best idea, certainly better than the previous idea. But there has been quite a bit of discussion about whether the timing shows the president's disregard for Congress or the president's lack of awareness of how putting something in front of Congress when another thing is about to sunset, this is the FISA bill, was deliberate or just unintentional. They're calling it sort of like he stepped on a rake by mistake. Yes. He didn't have to.
Right.
So I don't know. I'd actually like to hear what other people thought about that, because I tend to think there is always a clear strategy going on, and that chaos is not the actual approach here. And if that was the strategy, to put up somebody who was patently unqualified for the position and then to offer a second not qualified person but more qualified individual, was this a way to sort of get that second person in as a sort of strategy, or am I overreaching?
I think it might have more to do with the FISA authorization.
You think it's
not
FISA?
Wanting to lose that would be my hunch.
But we did lose it today.
Well, just temporarily. It's not off the table.
Yeah,
forever.
They can come back.
They can come back.
Right.
I mean, Pulte was a disaster. I think, Allison, you're giving the White House too much credit in terms of being strategic. Like, put some really, really unqualified cartoon character up, and then your second person is like, well, at least they're not Pulte. But every member of Congress who had concerns about Pulte being unqualified should have the same concerns about Clayton, a U.S. attorney with no real international experience. I think also you can be acting in the position for, I think, 9 months. I could be wrong on that, but I think the motivating factor here is Trump wants to screw around with the November elections, and having a DNI who's going to just be completely obedient and do whatever Trump tells him to do will help them with their November election strategy. So he does not have to be confirmed by then. He can be acting past November. And I think that's at play here, whether or not Congress decides to hold hearings on Clayton.
But Pulte is acting now.
Yeah.
He would have to be approved as the new...
Well, I think they can just pull out Pulte and replace him with Clayton.
That's the point, right?
But if it's about FISA...
Point on FISA is a good one, but I think they can reauthorize FISA after it expires at
midnight. They're saying they won't vote for FISA if Pulte is still acting. So
exactly.
I think they would have to... Mm-hmm. They're going to have to act on Clayton first.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I
think morning.
Good point. Yeah. I stand corrected, but I still think this is about the November election.
Maybe. I think it's about FISA, but be that as it may, this is the kind of thing I wish Trump would do more often. Clayton is, point well taken that he doesn't have the direct experience, but frankly, at that level, who does have direct experience? I mean, I work in education,
CIA.
So the thing that you hear under every administration, just as an analogy, is, oh, we need to put a teacher in charge of the Department of Education. Well, not necessarily. You need to have somebody who can credibly run a large organization. So Clayton is not an intelligence professional, but he's a considerably more conventional nominee than the administration's previous choice, obviously. So the question is whether he's qualified to run a large organization. This feels like Trump is choosing an intelligence chief rather than choosing someone he thinks he can trust. And again, I wish this president would make these kinds of decisions more often.
I'm blocking out his name. Who's nominated for Attorney General? What's that guy's name? The AG, the acting AG now.
Yes.
Todd Blanche.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
I think that was just a survival skill on my brain to block out Todd Blanche's name. But
you were like, not Bondi, not Bondi. Oh, wait.
But I raised this name because Clayton is U.S. attorney and lawyers are like, yeah, he has zero experience, but he's like a competent adult in the room. That's what they said about Todd Blanche. I mean, I remember hearing Preet Bharara talk about Todd Blanche being the honest and the consummate professional. I don't think anyone can say that now. I think when you're appointed by this administration, you're kind of like tofu in the refrigerator, and you take on the flavor of whatever is in the refrigerator.
Since I don't have tofu in my refrigerator, I have to decline.
Could this be a more public radio discussion?
Hopefully not in plastic. But
it's a hemp tote bag. It's public radio.
But I think any notion that you go in as an honest professional, I think you lose those skills in a nanosecond in this administration. Exhibit A, Todd Blanche.
So when you think of, though, I guess I'm going back to what sort of the overall changes. I'll be honest with all of you. I was reading this article, I guess it was last night in preparation, and they said we're a year and 6 months into the administration. I was like,
that's it?
Wow, is that all? Is that like
I feel
really,
so much older.
Like, wow. I mean, that and so you just and I I just because so much has gone on much has happened and we've been to war and we went through DOGE and there's just like all of these things.
Don't forget the concentration camps and the attack on immigrants.
I mean, just
screw worms.
A lot happening in a very short period of time and a long time to go. But it just seems that now. And Judith, this is what the point I wanted to get to in our few moments here before we have to go to a break, is that all about the midterms. And it, like right now, all of this seems to be it getting us to that, for want of a better term, halfway point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, the timeline, if the midterms go against the Republicans, and it certainly looks like it will, then that year and 6 months becomes compressed because then he is quite literally a lame duck.
And I think if the Democrats win big in both houses, which I don't take anything for granted, I think if it was just a straight up vote, that will likely happen. But I think there's going to be a lot of election interference. But if the Dems win both houses, you know, Trump will still be president, but they're going to have a lot of investigations. They're going to have guardrails. And I think Trump is just, he's going to be bored and he'll never resign, but I think you're going to see him exhibiting some quiet quitting. I think he's just going to not be as rambunctious as he has been in the last year and a half.
I've heard people say the opposite, that
he'll just go wild.
He'll be boring. He'll be bored, and yet, you know, let's see what I can do to.
Well, it could be either quiet
to
quitting
really rough
or,
up.
Yeah, or a nuclear war.
He managed
nothing
to
in between.
Quietly quit and play a lot of golf while also raising extraordinary amounts of chaos. So I am pretty sure that his version of quiet quitting and my version of quiet quitting are very different things.
He'll be 80 years old on Sunday, oldest president ever in the history of this country. And we'll be celebrating with the UFC fight on the front lawn of the
which is what most 80-year-olds do.
That's how I plan to celebrate 80.
In the ring or watching it?
In it.
In it. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm fighting it at 80. I figure, why not?
Not long. I'm with you.
Who's covering that? Do we know who's covering that?
It's being
Paramount.
Paramount. And it's pay to view.
Oh, yeah. Wow. All right.
There was a big.
Lots of financial conflicts. Crypto sponsorship.
God bless America.
And away we go. We'll come back. We have to It wouldn't be a Friday with Judith if we didn't talk about plastic pollution. So we have to check that off of our list before the Friday weekend. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We alluded to the story, and it is a New York bill that certainly attracted a lot of lobbying against it this legislative season, and that was the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act. It is known as PRRIA, and I know how much our listeners love when we use a lot of letters. So we will call it just that, the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act. And Judith, this is something that we have talked about on the show. You have mentioned it. The idea that heavy lobbying killed this. So what in the world happened?
Well, this was an environmental priority for many, and I want to start by commending our sponsors, Assemblymember Deborah Glick, who's retiring at the end of the year, and Senator Pete Harkin. They could not have worked harder. But we ran into a wall of special interest lobbyists opposing the bill. Last time we counted, there were 106 active lobbyists opposing the bill, and many of them were camped out at the Capitol, as I was. And the irony here is it only takes 76 votes to pass a bill in the Assembly, and we had 77 co-sponsors on the bill. So a majority of the New York State Assembly signed on as a co-sponsor. The bill was on the floor in the Assembly since January, but the Assembly Speaker would not bring it up for a vote the entire legislative session. And then in the final days, Speaker Hastie said he would not bring it up because he didn't think we had the votes. The only way to know that is if you bring it up for a vote. And the speaker's response is legislators tell you they're yes votes, but they're lying to you. And there's nothing I can do about legislators lying to us. There was massive support from local governments, from environmental justice organizations, great work by the NAACP, the environmental community. But I'm, you know, my observation is it was certainly disappointing not to get this bill over the finish line. But my deeper concern is how special interest lobbyists have a grip on Albany decision making.
So it is perhaps not a surprise that when you look at those special interests, that the people who are spending money to stop this, fossil fuel industry, chemical industries, Amazon, McDonald's, ..
Yeah, I mean, it's a rogue's gallery of polluters and special interests. And when you work on plastics, you know you're taking on, as you say, fossil fuel, plastics, chemical, consumer brand companies who are very invested in the status quo. But the status quo means we are drowning in plastic waste, and it's affecting our ocean, climate change, and our health. We now have a large number of peer-reviewed scientific studies showing the presence of microplastics in our blood, lungs, kidneys, the human placenta, microplastics across the blood-brain barrier, testicles. Our babies are being born pre-polluted, and then there's microplastics in breast milk. So it kind of reminds me of where the tobacco wars were about 25, 30 years ago. But we don't have a lot of time to turn the tide here.
I want to talk about that. But one of the things here, and you mentioned this, that one of the sponsors of this, of course, Deborah Glick, is retiring. So the future of this coming back is, I assume, of concern as well.
Well, we're definitely coming back. We're going to keep working on it, but we have to find a new assembly sponsor. And we will be, of course, we don't find the sponsor. The Senate sponsor finds the sponsor. But we will make some suggestions based on...
You don't
do,
like, interviews and stuff, right?
No.
That's not how that works.
No, it's really up to the Senate sponsor. But we definitely are looking for lawmakers who are willing to stand up to powerful special interests, go toe-to-toe with Exxon and Dow and DuPont and finally get this bill to come up for a vote. It's passed the Senate 2 years, not this year, but previous 2 years. So all eyes are on the state assembly.
Where else in the world, in this country, is a similar law on the books?
Well, there are parts of it on the books all over the world. Canadian provinces, parts of Europe have done kind of the bare bones, which is putting a fee on packaging with that money going toward recycling. But that doesn't solve the plastics problem because plastic recycling is an abysmal failure, as I outline in my book, The Problem with Plastics. So this bill...
Available wherever fine hardcovers are sold.
Bookshop.org or com. Is it com? Bookshop.com?
Org, I think.
Yeah,
an org.
I'm urging everyone not to buy from that company that starts with A.
Yeah.
So I've had a blast.
One of the companies that put money toward just killing this bill.
Just a coincidence.
Yes.
I've had a blast going to independent bookstores all over the country. It's just, I feel like I step in to a land that time is forgotten. It's so inspiring to see these bookstores.
Yeah.
But what was I saying?
Well, we were talking about the companies and Amazon and so forth. I don't really remember, Judith.
Yeah. The take home is the special interest opposition is huge, and we're going to keep going. And, you know, the problem is getting worse. Plastic pollution is not going anywhere, and neither are we. But the politics is really, really dicey. This is an election year. So not only did we have an army of lobbyists camped out at the Capitol opposing this, but on July 15th, conveniently after the session has adjourned, we'll see what campaign contributions were made.
One of the things, I guess, the motive for these companies is...
status quo. They are free riders. So if you're Amazon,
yes,
or McDonald's, you sell your product, you don't even think about what happens to the packaging afterwards because you and I spend tax dollars to either landfill, incinerate, or recycle the packaging. So they're free riders. So they don't want anything that gives them financial responsibility. In addition, our bill banned some of the most toxic chemicals used in packaging, PFAS chemicals, lead, formaldehyde, mercury. Those chemicals are currently used in packaging that touches our food and beverage. And the bill also required a 30% reduction in single-use packaging over 12 years. There were 68 major amendments, concessions to the industry over the last few years, but it still was not enough to neutralize their opposition. I have never seen so much special interest opposition to a single bill than this one.
Obviously, you knew there was going to be opposition. What surprised you, though?
What surprised me was the statement by the speaker, and it's 2 years in a row now, that yes, you have enough co-sponsors to pass the bill, but legislators are lying to you. That's not a good look for an assembly leader to say about their colleagues. And we talked to so many of these legislators. We believe we have the votes to pass it. Our headcount was a nice little cushion. And, you know, the speaker says he only brings bills to the floor that he knows are going to pass. So what is, like, is all the floor debate just performative? Let people decide.
I'm glad we got time for this issue. And it's one thing. Were there other things within? Was there any good news that came out of the state budget?
The state budget, no. That was all bad news. The governor led on...
or session, I should say.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, let me just touch on the budget for a moment. So,
yep,
unfortunately, the budget significantly weakened the state's climate change law, led by the governor, and the legislature went along. The budget significantly weakened the State Environmental Quality Review Act, or SEQR. And then a little sleeper issue originated by Senator Ryan, a Democrat of Syracuse, is they delayed the requirements for school districts to buy electric buses by 5 years. You know, right now the fleet of buses are mostly diesel, and so the law was prospectively you only bought electric buses, which is really good for children's health, especially if they have asthma, and the bus drivers. But that was kicked down the road by 5 years. One good thing in this legislative session was that both houses passed a one-year moratorium on new data centers so that local governments and state government can get a handle on all the electricity and water being used by these data centers. For local listeners, there's a giant data center proposed for the old Doan Stewart School in the south end of Albany.
Right.
Now, that bill started out as a three-year moratorium. The legislature reduced it to 1 year, and we don't know whether Governor Hochul will sign or veto the bill.
Well, we are out of time, so we're going to give Judah Thank the last word on the panel this morning. I know you hate that, and our thanks obviously to Judith, Allison Cavey, Robert Pendicio. We will continue. Don't forget, we have a Pride Month special coming up on music and film during Pride Month, and much, much more coming up. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.